Ah, mmm. The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
It's Wednesday, March 13th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. News reports have Robert F. Kennedy Jr., presidential candidate, supposedly, allegedly, can't count all the ballots, but he's narrowed it down, these news reports say. He's narrowed down the vice presidential candidates, who his running mate may be. High on the list, Jesse Ventura, not just a wrestler and a co-star in Commando with the late Carl Weathers, but a heterodox politician in his own right. And then, leader of men, questioner of COVID, Aaron Rodgers was on the list. Former Green Bay Packer great and New York Jet slight, Aaron Rodgers. Now, if Robert Kennedy Jr. wanted to pick a running mate whose career was disabled in New Jersey, Chris Christie is right out there. Why did he go with Aaron Rodgers? Maybe, allegedly, supposedly. Rodgers is not exactly denying it. Well, I think it's because football is unbelievably dominant. And do you remember just a few years ago when it seemed like, I mean, not to me, but maybe to some people, that football was on the way out? Kids were supposedly signing up in fewer numbers to play it, and Malcolm Gladwell predicted it would be dead in 10 years. Well, this year, 2023, the NFL accounted for, out of the top 100 most watched U.S. programs on TV, you want to guess? 93 of the top 100. The Super Bowl was the most watched TV show ever, so of course politicians want to get into the game. Remember when Trump thought it was a good idea to turn people against the NFL or to turn NFL fans against him? I mean, he always still wanted to be friends with Tom Brady, which wasn't happening, but now RFK picks Rodgers. There's, of course, all the buzz about Travis Kelce as some secret operative who would be endorsing Biden. And we could break this news now. I have it on good authority that before Dean Phillips dropped out of the race, he was very close to getting the endorsement of Barkevious Mingo. Barkevious Mingo. For 12.5 career sacks. Should I have gone with Mitch Trubisky? No, I like Barkevious Mingo. You know what? A lot of them are for you. Most of them are for us. That one's for me. Will you allow it? I hope you do. On the show today, I give Joy Reid a fair hearing on the her hearing and conclude that I can't hear her on her anymore. Hear, hear. But first, Kiko Toro is back. He's a contributing editor at Persuasion. He's a founder of the Caracas Chronicles, so he does a lot of stuff for us on the show on the geopolitics of South America and Central America, but he's also an excellent writer on environmental issues. You can follow his Substack on kikotoro.com, kikotoro.com, and he's going to talk with us about climate doomerism. He'll answer the question, is Greta Thunberg a useful voice in the climate conversation? Kiko Toro up next. Hi, I'm here to talk about Surfshark, the VPN. Surfshark. What's a VPN? Well, VPN, of course, stands for a very porcine narwhal. No, it doesn't. It doesn't stand for a pig-like unicorn whale, but it is, in fact, versatile, like that animal might be. A VPN is a virtual private network. It's an extremely useful tool. One pretty common way to use it, let's say you're a subscriber to, I'll throw out a brand name, Netflix, and you would like to access the Netflix catalog that they might have in France or the Czech Republic, you can do that. Tis your ability with a VPN. Or what I do is I like a lot of the podcasts that are available on certain national broadcasters prominent in Europe, but you can't always hear them here. But if you were in Europe, if you were in the UK, you could. I use it for that. Paywalls, there is another thing. I'm in favor in general of paying for journalism, and I do. Oh boy, do I. But sometimes you just need to read that third article and you're locked out after a second. With a VPN, you can access it. Plus, think of it like a mask. You don't always want everyone tracking your activity online. And don't think of a mask as you're doing something sneaky or surreptitious. Think of the masks we wore during COVID when it was necessary to do so. It's just about hygiene. The Surfshark VPN provides that service as well. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/gist. Enter promo code GIST for 3 extra months for free. You heard me right, 3 extra months for free. That's surfshark.deals/gist.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
So if you listen to The Gist, you know that my take on the climate and climate doomerism is that we have serious challenges. The climate is changing. The climate is changing for the worse. It is getting hotter. We have to acknowledge this. We should do whatever we can to stop it. And part of the things that we should do is not work ourselves up into such a tizzy that we're paralyzed by fear and that fear, that negativity infects the rest of our lives. I don't know. It's a little bit subtle, but maybe you understand where I'm coming from. Big, serious challenge that we should do something about. We've had other such challenges in the past. We've, at least as America, mostly surmounted them. That doesn't mean that this challenge won't be in a different category. Okay, you get that. There are many other ways to look at this. And one is, I think someone like me would call it doomerism. But the best way to describe looking at the climate in a totally non-sanguine way might not be doomerism. It might be realism. And if we're not looking at it through the lens of bad things are happening and are going to happen, face it and deal with it, maybe we're fooling ourselves a little. Kiko Toro, who contributes at Persuasion and blogs at kikotoro.com, he encapsulates this other view, a view that is, I think, more pessimistic than I am, but I'm also going to say probably more informed about what's really going on with the climate. Kiko, welcome back to The Gist.
Thank you.
Question one, what do you think of the word doomerism as applied to climate change and the attitudes thereof, as I used it just now?
Well, doom is a feeling, and the atmosphere doesn't really think or care about your feelings very much. I think what we're trying to do here is we're trying to take these geophysical variables and put them in the language of how the audience is going to react to it, because there's been this absolute imperative to not bum out your climate audience. And that's what most climate journalism has ended up being about. If there's a story that it looks likely to scare people, then these stories tend to get suppressed. I mean, not suppressed in the sense that somebody's going to come and censor them. There's not some government office doing this, but in the sense that editors just won't okay it because it's not good for clicks and because it bumps audiences out. That's ended up meaning that we don't really understand the big picture about the climate because the big picture is so scary, it's not really reported.
I will acknowledge that in the last couple of years, I have seen that trend. And I think if you look at just Guardian, you contributed to The Guardian. If you just look at their headlines, 10 years ago, the initiative was to underline just how bad the climate is and to take it seriously. 2 years ago, there was a bit of a reversal talking about, and this is also reflected in the international community, and the UN saw the need to message things this way. And there was a reversal about, you know, still the possibilities of change. So I do think that there was, like the climate itself, it goes a little, or it ebbed and flowed a bit. However, I want to talk about the idea of not bumming the audience out. If you're in your assessment, if you're just going to tell it to them straight, give me the things that we need to know about why it's not just a dire situation, but probably an unsolvable situation.
We always lose sight of the fact that there are really two worlds of climate. There's one world, the developed world, where emissions are coming down, not fast, but they are like 17% down from their peak in 2007. We have these new technologies coming online, and they're coming online slowly, but it is working. Demand for energy isn't growing that fast. So that's the story that we'd like to tell ourselves. There's progress, it's not fast enough, but like we're almost here. This is only tenable if you completely ignore the developing world, which is where most people in the world live, is where two out of every three molecules of CO2 going into the atmosphere are coming from, and where emissions are not coming down, they're rising. They're rising very fast. So the overall effect ends up being that people in the developed world want to have a conversation about what we can do. And this is what anti-bumming you out climate journalism always does, is tell you, how can you have a low impact kid? Right. What can you do personally in your life? What we don't want to hear, because it scares us, even though it's true, is that this is more and more beside the point. The problem is not what we do. The problem is that emissions are growing very fast in the developing world that we don't have any purchase into.
Right. So it doesn't matter how much recycling you do or how much you offset your carbon footprint. Anyone within the sound of my voice, what a billion and a half Indians are doing is much more important to the climate than, you know, your own amelioration efforts, which may help the climate, but will probably just assuage your guilt more.
According to the International Energy Agency, according to a report that they just put out 2 weeks ago, between now and the year 2026, India is going to add the electrical generating capacity of all of the UK, and a third of that will come from coal. In the meantime, if you read British newspapers, they're having these fratricidal wars over where you put the next wind farm, which is going to change British emissions by 0.3% over the next decade. We're really having an argument about a rounding error on top of another rounding error. So it's just we're not having a realistic discussion about what the actual drivers of the climate crisis are now or what we should do about them.
Yeah. But in the developed world, if it was just looking at our emissions and our trends and our technology, and I'm asking this for a reason, not to be blind to what's going on in the developing world, but is it the case that actually things are looking much more optimistic than we even thought a decade ago?
I mean, they're looking more optimistic. Emissions are coming down. If you look at the trend line of where emissions would, how fast emissions would need to come down to hit anything like net zero, they're still not coming down fast enough, even in the developed world.
Right. But California pledged no internal combustion cars in 2030 or 2040 or whatever timeline it was out in the future.
What about sure. That? Sure. But you end up in this situation. What often happens is that you see progress in one jurisdiction.
Yeah.
But then at the same time as that's happening, Germany shut down all of its nuclear power stations, and now they're digging for coal. And so even within the developed world, progress in one place ends up getting overwhelmed by people going backwards in other places. But again, the entire conversation that we tend to have is about the developed world, and it just leaves out the bulk of the problem. 85% of new demand for electricity between now and 2026 is going to come from the developing countries. And what really scares us is to think that like the decisions that affect our future are going to be made by like a bureaucrat in Beijing or some like electric utility official in, I don't know, in Ethiopia or Nigeria or somewhere else. But those are the places where the decisions will be made. So I just feel like climate is a very serious crisis. If we're going to have an honest conversation about this, we should at least have it on the basis of the things that we know are true, because I'm not making up any of these statistics. These things come from very well-established sources in the IEA and like the European Union and places like this.
Well, one thing that analysis does, and we hear where you're coming from, is it at least addresses the common question, which I think is a little bit of a crazy question. Should I have children? If the person asking the question lives in America or Germany or the quote unquote developed world, yeah, have children. You're not part of the solution or the problem anyway.
yeah, I think we need to really depersonalize this entire question. Sometimes I get the sense that the most taboo thing you can say about climate change is climate change is not about you. It's not about your personal decisions. It's not even about your politicians or your big companies. It's a much bigger problem than that. And if we're going to look at solutions, we need to look at them at the appropriate level of analysis, which is not national. It's certainly not your city. It's certainly not your household. It's definitely not you and your kids. It's global. So this is where the conversation needs to happen.
Do you think Greta Thunberg has been a useful voice in this conversation?
Look, anytime you have someone passionate trying to bring attention to this issue, I think I'm generally in favor of that. But I do worry that her type of activism goes back to flattering this kind of narcissistic approach in the West, where we think it's really about us and it's really about pressuring developed country companies and developed country politicians and developed country consumers. And it brings us away from an understanding of the basic dynamic, which is that this is increasingly a problem whose future trajectory is going to be developed not by people who look and sound like you. The people who are going to make the decisions that determine the future of the climate don't understand our memes.
Yeah. I look at Greta Thunberg as a symbol of a lot of what you're talking about. I think she is a Cassandra, a doomerish voice. You're right. If you're going to be a climate denialist or Senator James Inhofe, then Greta Thunberg is smarter than you are on the issue. However, I do think, and this was up until a few years ago, the most doomerish, hopeless, angry voices on this issue were being elevated or got a lot of clicks, got passed around a lot. She was one of them. Dave Roberts, who used to write for Vox, is just relentlessly negative on issues of the climate. Even Penn professor Michael Mann, who has recently taken a more there is still hope out there approach because that is the flavor of the moment. He's also relentlessly negative online, just in his personal comportment, but as well as his issue of on the issue of climate. So I do think that they haven't done us a service. And it's not that they got it right or wrong. It's that what they're pointing at is more of an outgrowth of their emotional state than, you know, a cool assessment of what's going on with climate. And the assessment isn't that things are going well. I think the assessment is more of what you're saying. What we're worried about and pointing our fingers at are just the wrong things.
Yeah. And I also want to say, I'm not actually personally a doomer because I think there are technologies that can scale, that can and will ultimately make a huge impact on curbing the worst effects of the climate crisis. It's just that they don't feel green, so we don't want to talk about them. You know, a nuclear power plant does not feel green, but if you want to have an electric grid that is stable, that is reliable, and that is zero emissions, you don't really have a choice. You need a nuclear power plant backbone to your electric grid. We're not ready yet to face up to that, but I think we're going to get there as the effects of climate change become more and more extreme. That takes time, though. A nuclear power plant takes time to build. I'm sure that within 10, 15 years, we're going to be talking about more extreme kinds of things that also don't feel green, that we're not really comfortable talking about right now, but which are clearly technically feasible, like injecting aerosols into the stratosphere. Nobody wants to talk about it, but everybody knows that there is a possibility. So we are on a train that is careening faster and faster towards a cliff, and there is a little sign that says emergency brake on the side, and everybody knows it's there. Nobody wants to pull it because we're not scared enough yet, but we're eventually going to.
And that train isn't a Japanese bullet train or an Amtrak. It's a train in the tracks of Bangladesh or Nigeria.
Exact.
So here's the last thing, though, the wrinkle in all this. Up until now, the United States had been the greatest and still has the status of historically the greatest emitter of carbon gases. And we have always been told, and it was accurate, that even though the developed world emitted, the costs were borne by the developing world the most. Now that the developing world is emitting, as countries get richer, they eat more meat, they emit more carbon gases, there's a reason they do that. It helps the populace. Wealth increases, and the ability to have technology that emits more gases helps the development of people. Is it getting somehow, in some way, more fair? I don't know if anyone is consciously making the choice that it's worth it, but it does seem that you could look at the situation as saying, well, at least the developing world is, if they're going to bear the brunt of the problem, now they're getting the benefits of the technology that's creating the problem.
Well, yes, except that the worst effects will also be in the developing world. I mean, have you ever been in like Mumbai or like Jakarta on a really hot day?
No, I haven't. South Korea, but it's not Jakarta, yeah.
Right. I mean, there are places where it's already very hard to live and they may just become unlivable. I mean, if we're going to look for a positive aspect to this catastrophe that we're facing, I think it is. Yeah, it's along the lines of what you're saying, is that we will in the next 20 years come to understand climate change for what it is, a crisis that affects mostly the developing countries, but also a crisis where most of the decisions that will affect the future outcomes are in the hands of the developing countries. So what we really need is for the developing countries to take ownership of the process. And that's something we don't have right now. If you go to the COP conferences that the UN holds, you find that the discussion is really led by the big developed countries, which have the biggest delegations, the most scientists, their companies, their lobbies. They're still in charge of the international debate, but they no longer have their hands on the reins of the most important variables going forward.
Yeah, and I would also say a complication is that in the developed world, the will of the people is more disconnected to leadership. In general, you know, it's not always great in our part of the world, but is Modi really keeping in mind the best, or Modi or whoever comes after him, keeping in mind the best interests of all of his people to the extent that Angela Merkel was? I don't know. And that's a problem too.
Well, I mean, one thing I can tell you is that Modi knows very well that if the lights don't come on when people flick a switch, people are mad. Okay. And so he is under strong political pressures to make sure that the grid expands and the generation expands quickly enough to meet Indian people's legitimate aspirations. There is nothing more legitimate than expecting the light to come on when you flick a switch. So the question is, that's not actually the question that worries me. I think developing country leaders understand very well what is expected of them and what their populations expect of them. Now, the question is, what can we in the developed world do to help them to meet those expectations without wrecking the climate more?
Kiko Toro is a contributing editor at Persuasion. He blogs about issues including the climate, or primarily the climate, at his blog, QUICOTORO.com. Kiko Toro. Thank you, Kiko.
Thanks so much.
In this age of abundance, the key when it comes to meals is not just to get something in you, it's to get something good, delicious, good for you. Maybe you're a foodie, if you are a real one, you don't like to use that term, but you know going to a great restaurant that you're all excited about, there are reservations, there are bad tables, there's expensive and sometimes disappointing experiences. So let's say that doesn't work out, you try to throw together something from your pantry, or you're not as skilled a cook as maybe some of these great cooks are. Well, there is a service that I have been trying where the meals are delicious and plentiful and the people making them are experts. It's a collective of cooks who got together to give you a bevy, an abundance, yes, a cornucopia of delights. I had mission-style beef burritos made by Jose Garces, shrimp and smoked andouille sausage, is that it? With charred zucchini, It was charred for me. Isn't that nice? Esther Choi made me Korean flank steak rice bowl and asparagus. Thank you, Esther. Cook Unity is the name of the service. What I love about it is, oh my God, they have, you could say, you know, I am a pescatarian, which I am, but I also eat other things. You could say I don't have soy. Give me choices without dairy. They had here where I live 240 choices. You could order a couple weeks ahead and the meals come cooked, prepared. You just heat them up and they are delicious. The packaging is reusable. They last for a week. It's mostly about the quality and the variety, but every other thing that you think about, like not too much excess packaging, ease of delivery. When you go on the site, couldn't be easier to order. They tell you how many calories. They tell you the nutrition information. I love that. Not eating blind. For instance, the Mediterranean quinoa bowl with shrimp and tzatziki dressing was, you know, it made my heart sing. At 497 grams, only 4 grams of which were saturated fat. What protein? Micronutrient rundown. Just great stuff. Couldn't recommend it enough. Now we get to the price. And this is, I think, the biggest selling point. Especially now, for Gist listeners. Experience chef-quality meals every week delivered right to the door. Go to cookunity.com/thegist or enter code THEGIST before checkout for 50% off your first week. That's 50% off your first week by using the code THEGIST or going to cookunity.com/thegist. This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Today, I realized I'm not a Democrat. Well, I am a Democrat. That is my party registration. I have always resisted registering as such. I, for many years, didn't think it was proper for a journalist to declare a political party. This took me up to 2016 when I did register as a Democrat, figuring that if I was going to make a reasonable case that reasonable people could look at both parties and find something reasonable to like, that is all blown up when Donald Trump is the standard bearer of one of the parties. So even if a good journalist could absent himself or herself from choosing sides, that was, you know, the time to choose. And in doing so, there was an added bonus. I got to de facto enfranchise myself, right? As a New Yorker or a Brooklynite, I don't know, it was not much fun having absolutely no say or no impact or no meaning in any election that would ever come before me. Anyway, here I am, a literal registered Democrat, but certainly an independent by inclination. But, you know, on national issues, even on local issues, I try to think of things not as reflexively one party or another and not to fall into traps or mindsets or narratives, independent thinking. And then Robert Herr comes along and Robert Herr says Joe Biden had a poor memory. And I say, yeah, that sounds about right. Didn't you say that too? I think most reasonable people did. But the entire Democratic world said, how dare you? How could you? That is so improper and gratuitous. That is the common, most frequent word to talk about that phrase in the Herr report about Joe Biden being an elderly man with a poor memory. I suppose Herr could have said, Biden, he's slipping a little bit. He's not the steel trap he used to be. But he didn't say that. He said he was elderly, which is true. He's 81 and would come across as sympathetic, which is also true and actually pretty kind, but that he had a poor memory. I myself have a poor memory, not the memory I used to have. If someone described me as having a poor memory, I might say, I don't know if it's poor, but it's not really that good. I mean, just the other day, I was trying to remember, there was a guy, and I was trying to remember the name of this guy in my neighborhood where I grew up, and he was a really nice guy, and I talked to him a lot, but he would sometimes you could catch him in his underwear, and I was like, what? And then he had me, Dad, that was his name. Anyway, in this case, I think it's that Democrats, if you're a Democrat, if you're really a Democrat and feel like you're a Democrat, maybe some other people, but they just chafe at the idea so much, or the exaggeration of Joe Biden as completely out of it or incapable or doddering or dithering. And that's unfair. But then when they hear a fair critique of Biden as having a poor memory, right, accurate, factual, borne out by evidence, they fear or they feel that it will get interpreted as something much worse than it is. And this is an accurate assessment. They say this will be turned into another of these Republican disinformation campaigns where this phrase, poor memory, becomes the guy is drooling in his soup 24 hours a day. So yesterday during the Herr hearing, which I played extensive clips for you, my point being both sides, and I don't like to necessarily both sides it, but in this case, both the Democrats and the Republicans on the panel were really, really tendentious. The Democrats did try to challenge the idea of Biden having a bad memory. They put some of the evidence to Herr. I thought Herr answered it pretty well. I didn't dwell too much on their failed attempts to confront Herr with inconsistencies. The greater point being, no, Joe Biden does have a good memory. There are other things to talk about, but not to Joy Reid of MSNBC. MSNBC, pretty much now the media arm of the DNC. They went to work. There was a piece headlined, I mean, this is the online version, Biden memory issues were a lie, probe transcripts and special counsel Robert Herr testimony show. A lie? Under oath, Robert Herr committed perjury? That's a felony. Well, let's hear MSNBC host Joy Reid present her case.
Now, let's not forget that a major part of this hearing was Republicans hoping to keep alive Mr. Herr's gratuitous description of Biden in his report as a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory and diminished faculties. While having nothing to do with the classified documents, Herr made the claim in his report that during his five-hour interview, Biden was unable to remember key dates, including when his son Beau died of cancer. Oh, and you better believe the right wing ran with that claim as further proof that Biden is too old to be commander-in-chief. Yeah, except we now have the transcript of the interview right here that shows it was a lie.
A lie. It was a lie that Joe Biden could not remember because we have the transcripts. Well, I too have reviewed the transcripts, and in them you find Joe Biden saying variations of I don't remember or I don't know more than 50 times. That was the New York Times count. NPR expanded the search to include phrases like I don't know, I don't specifically remember, or I have no goddamn idea. They got 100 hits on that one. There were also some phrases of I don't know, where the hell, and there's probably photographs in there, my guess, of the Corvette. I'm not positive. So well over 100 times did Joe Biden not have a good memory. I will read you, and this is from the Herr report. I will read you the statement that Robert Herr wrote in his summary that led to the assertion that, quote, Joe Biden could not remember key dates, including when his son Beau Biden died of cancer. Here's that portion in the report. In his interview with our office, Mr. Biden's memory was worse. He did not remember when he was vice president, forgetting on the first day of the interview when his term ended. If it was 2013, when did I stop being vice president? And forgetting on the second day of the interview when his term began. Quote, in 2009, am I still vice president? He did not remember, even within several years, when his son Beau died. So that's a lie, right? It's not a lie, because we have the transcript. Mr. Herr. So during this time when you were living at Chainbridge Road and there were documents relating to the Penn Biden Center or the Biden Institute or the Cancer Moonshot or your book, where did you keep papers that related to those things that you were actively working on, President Biden? Well, I don't know. This is what? 2017, 2018, that area, Mr. Herr, yes, sir, President Biden. Remember, in this time frame, my son is either been deployed or is dying. And so it was, by the way, there were still a lot of people at the time when I got out of the Senate that were encouraging me to run in this period, except the president. I'm not a mean thing to say, just thought that she, meaning Clinton, Hillary, had a better chance of winning the presidency than I did. And so I hadn't at this point, even though I'm at Penn, I hadn't walked away from the idea that I may run for office again. But if I ran again, I'd be running for president. And so what was happening, though? What month did Beau die? Oh, God, May 30th, Ms. Cotton, who's an aide. 2015, unidentified male speaker. 2015, President Biden. Was it 2015 he had died? Unidentified male speaker. It was May of 2015. President Biden. It was 2015. There we have in the report, Joe Biden saying 2017, 2018, that was when Beau was either deployed or dying. And then he was reminded, no, it was 2015. That comports with the statement that he could not recall within several years, all right, not very many years, but within several years when Beau Biden had died. It's not horrible. It's not unforgivable. It's not beyond comprehension. I'm really bad with dates too. Maybe you are too. It doesn't mean much more than what you just heard. But it is also not Joe Biden correctly recalling, without assistance from staff and lawyers, what year his son Beau Biden died, which is exactly, him not recalling the year Beau Biden died, exactly what Herr noted in the report. Here is Joy Reid covering a moment where a representative of Pennsylvania, Madeline Dean, confronts Herr on the date question.
And even when Herr was called out on it today by Congresswoman Madeline Dean, he doubled down.
I want to give you a chance, since the transcript is out, to correct the record on an important point. Very sadly, your report on page 208 says that Mr. Biden couldn't come up with the date, the year of his son, Beau Biden's death, when in fact in the transcript it shows that you asked him the month. And do you know what he said, Mr. Herr? He said, oh God, May 30th. Would you like to correct the record? His memory was pretty firm on the month and the day.
Congresswoman, I don't believe that's correct with respect to the transcript.
Oh, well, Mr. Herr, we have the transcript too.
Yes, we have the transcript too. We also have the rest of the exchange that Reid didn't play. Now, this part isn't earth-shattering, but I'll play it for you and I'll lay the case that I'm going to make. So here's Robert Herr answering Dean a little more fully than they played on MSNBC.
And I want to give you a chance, since the transcript is out, to correct the record on an important point. Very sadly, your report on page 208 says that Mr. Biden couldn't come up with the date, the year of his son, Beau Biden's death, when in fact in the transcript it shows that you asked him the month. And do you know what he said, Mr. Herr? He said, oh God, May 30th. Would you like to correct the record? His memory was pretty firm on the month and the day.
Congresswoman, I don't believe that's correct with respect to the transcript, but if you could refer me to a specific page, I'd be happy to look.
I've read about it in reporting. Thank you. I yield back.
Herr is right. Madeline Dean and Joy Reid are not right. I'm not accusing anyone of lying, but Herr is not wrong. Dean gets a piece of this wrong. She says, when in fact the transcript, you asked him the month. That's not how it happened. He didn't ask the month. So in the hearing, Herr says, let's go back to the actual transcript. And she said, well, I just read about it. It's not a nitpick. It was a central part of the Democratic response. You heard me read the transcript, right? You heard that Robert Herr never brought up Beau Biden's death. Biden brought it up himself. Now, the day that the special counsel released the report, Biden was mad. He got his Irish up. And among the things he said was this.
There's even reference that I don't remember when my son died. How in the hell dare he raise that? Frankly, when I was asked the question, I thought to myself, it wasn't any of their damn business.
And that is not true. I will not call it a lie. I think, you know, it's possible that Joe Biden just doesn't remember exactly how it happened. Oh, no, wait. Oh, my God. I can't say that. That's worse, apparently, even when it's accurate. It's worse to ever say. So I guess we could help Joe Biden out by saying he was just lying when he asked how dare Robert Herb brought it up. Now, a friend of mine, very fair-minded friend who heard yesterday's show, and I love him for listening, gave me a call, and I do appreciate being dialed up, get pesca on the horn on the blower, like that. And he said, well, what about the Eric Swalwell question that her said Biden had photographic recall, which I took to mean, oh, a photographic memory? He's compliments Biden and says, you, sir, have a photographic memory? And that part wasn't in the report. All right. I watched the whole hearing. I remember that short exchange. The phrase photographic recall was on one of those big boards behind a visual behind Swalwell when he was talking. Here's Joy Reid setting up that part of the hearing.
And in fact, when it came to Biden's memory, her actually complimented him during the interview, even though that never came up in the report.
You said to President Biden, you appear to have a photographic understanding and recall of the House. Did you say that to President Biden?
Those words do appear on page 47 of the transcript.
Photographic is what you said. Is that right?
That word does appear on page 47 of the transcript.
Never appeared in your report, though. Is that correct? The word photographic?
That does not appear in my report.
You see, the funny how that happened, right?
That does seem pretty damning that her told Joe Biden you got a photographic memory or photographic recall. But here's the context from the report. So her asked Biden about his lake house. Did you ever take classified material there? And then Biden answers at length, at great length. Well, it wasn't a lake house. It was more of a pond house. And you go there and there's a pool table and a couch and then a big fireplace. And you know, you could actually buy your desk as a senator. It's true. And you could buy the chairs. And Biden did that. And he gave a eulogy to Teddy Kennedy and a eulogy to Strom Thurmond. And who does that? A eulogy to both those guys. By the way, once you give a good eulogy, everyone asks you to use his eulogy and then back to the house and quote, and a couch and bookshelving and a television in there. And there is a file cabinet in there. Plus the file cabinets on the credenza behind that open with two big file drawers, and there's file drawers in my on the desk, and so there's another, and then things piled up. Okay, now we're getting to the draft board, right? You sit there and draft designs, and I have more stuff packed up there now. And what happens is, now I'm sorry, you're like, Mike, why are you giving me all this? A little bit of context. He's winding up to this. As vice president and as president, a photographer takes hundreds of pictures of you. And if you're on the way out, so you know what we're talking about, you walk by them, just so you know what I'm talking about, is there are pictures that are put on kind of a board. What is it? Mr. Siskel, and it says poster board, President Biden, a poster board or a sticker. And now he gets into the photographs. And there's great pictures of all kinds of things. And I have them hanging on all the walls, all over the downstairs. And now Biden tells a long story about visiting Mongolia and archery, and he hits a target with a bow and arrow, and there's a photograph of it, and the prime minister couldn't pull the arrow out, and the, quote, poor son of a bitch couldn't pull it back, and everyone laughs. And then President Biden, quote, anyway, so I have pictures like that, you know, that are up against the wall, and down here they're all over in the West Wing. Anyway, a lot of those pictures that you remember seeing them piled up, I know there must be 50 of them. I don't know what to do with them, you know? So there's a lot of stuff in the attic that is material that some of it is, you know, I think some of it is in notebooks of mine. I'm not sure. But anyway, that's the totality of where things would be. Mr. Herr understood. That was very helpful. We have some photographs, maybe to show you. But you appear to have a photographic understanding and recall of the house. That was the photographic memory. It wasn't a reference to photographic memory. It wasn't a reference to photographic recall. They were talking about photographs. Her was saying, yeah, we get it. You have a lot of photographs. You remember the photographs. And also all the parts about Biden describing every nook and cranny of the house. You have a recall of the house. That was it. That was what Robert Herr didn't put in his report because it is irrelevant to the report. He was just trying in that moment in the conversation to get onto something relevant. Do you think, by the way, that Joe Biden has a photographic memory? Do you think Robert Hur thinks that Joe Biden has a photographic memory? What are we talking about? We're talking about photographs. I conclude that none of what Hur said was a lie. Some of what Dean and Swalwell said was not a lie also. It's fine for a Democratic official who's protecting their president. It wasn't more accurate than when Hur said. I think Hur was more accurate in those exchanges. What Joy Reid said also wasn't a lie, but it was, in fact, further from the truth and the facts that either the supposedly partisan Robert Hur or the actual partisan politicians were. If you want to get to a lie, the closest we come is Joe Biden and his fiery denunciation of Robert Hur the day the special counsel's report came out. The good thing for all of us is that this is a minor political kerfuffle, and in the medium to short term, we thankfully will not even remember it. And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the producer. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. They're the quaint mallards. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. All hail Barkevius Mingo. Umpru-ji-pru-du-pru, and thanks for listening.